Well, good afternoon, everyone. I'm Francis Collins, the director of the National Human Genome Research Institute, which is part of the National Institutes of Health. It's my pleasure to serve as the MC for this afternoon's press conference. But let me remind the press about the 4 p.m. embargo, since this announcement is associated with a paper being published in tomorrow's issue of Science Magazine. 20 years ago, when I was a medical resident, I already had some interest in the field of genetics, and I asked a professor who I thought was particularly knowledgeable on that topic if he could name for me a disorder that did not have a genetic component. Without missing a beat, he said, well, yeah, I can think of it at least one. That's Parkinson's disease. Everybody knows that Parkinson's disease is purely environmental and that there is no inherited contribution to that illness. Today, I think it's fair to say we have proved my honored professor quite wrong, because we're here to talk about a major milestone in Parkinson's disease research. Using the powerful tools of the Human Genome Project, researchers at the NIH have identified for the first time a specific gene which, when misspelled in a subtle and particular way, confers a very high risk to that person of developing Parkinson's disease. Before introducing the speakers, I would like to recognize the representatives here today from several organizations dedicated to finding the cause and cure of Parkinson's disease. From the National Parkinson Foundation, a number of folks are here. I will mention particularly Mr. Nathan Slewitt, the chairman of the National Parkinson's Foundation. Maybe you could raise your hand so that people can see who you are. And I'd encourage the press to take note of these representatives if you would like to talk to them at the conclusion of the formal program. From the American Parkinson Disease Foundation, Paul Smedberg, the director of the Washington office, here in the front, welcome. From the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, Robin Elliott, the executive director, represented here by this young lady, thank you. From the Parkinson's Action Network, Joan Samuelson, the president, founder, and director, sitting here in the front. And I was told Mrs. Norma Udall is also intending to be present. Welcome to you. The order of presenters, who I will briefly introduce now and then basically ask them to come to the podium in turn without further interruption, is as follows. The first presenter will be Dr. Harold Varmus, the director of the National Institutes of Health. Following him will be Dr. Mihalis Polymeropoulos of the National Human Genome Research Institute, a geneticist and psychiatrist who is the lead author of this paper and will describe the nature of the scientific discovery. Following him, Dr. Robert Nussbaum, also of the Genome Institute, who's the senior author on this paper, who will address the significance of this finding from his vantage point as a medical geneticist. Next, Dr. Zach Hall, director of the Neurology Institute at NIH, who will give a perspective from his view as director of this institute and as a neuroscientist about how this fits in with Parkinson's disease research in the past and in the future. And then I'll have a brief comment at the end about the rapid pace of gene discovery and also something about the need for protections against misuse of this kind of genetic information, which this discovery once again reminds us of. So without further ado, each speaker will make a brief statement. At the end, we will have time for questions. Dr. Varmus.
Good afternoon. It wasn't very long ago that many of us gathered in this very same room to hear about a gene located on chromosome 4 that appeared to be implicated in Parkinson's disease in one large family in Italy. In a time that is much shorter than most of us would have thought, and certainly much shorter than any of us would have promised, we're back to talk about the gene itself, its isolation, determination of its sequence, identification of the mutation, and a discussion of the implications that its discovery might have for understanding Parkinson's disease and indeed many other things. I'd like to make three brief points before I turn the podium over to the scientists who actually did the work. The first is that, as on our previous meeting here to talk about the pinpointing of the gene to chromosome 4, the work that you're hearing about represents a remarkable collaboration across institutes, between NIH and NIH-supported scientists outside of our campus, between scientists of very different disciplines, clinicians, geneticists, biochemists, neuroscientists. It is this kind of collaborative effort that keeps NIH going, and it accounts for many of our most important discoveries, because indeed it is the intersection of disciplines that gives us our greatest prizes. Secondly, I'd like to comment on the implication of this finding for science in the future. As you'll hear, the gene of interest is a gene we already knew about. And it's a gene we already knew about because other people have been working on neuroscience from some other perspectives. This is going to have implications for the study of cell biology in general, for the understanding of how a nerve cell works, for understanding other central nervous system diseases like Alzheimer's, and it's this fertilizing effect of important discoveries that is so vital to biomedical discovery. The third point is one that I'm sure you'll hear from other speakers, and that is today we are unveiling a milestone, but we are not at the end of the road. We don't understand how the mutation you'll hear about actually causes the disease. There's a mechanism to be sorted out, one that I believe will be deeply important. We don't know the utility of this discovery for the management, diagnosis, prognostic analysis, or treatment of this disease. And finally, we don't understand the significance yet of this discovery for other diseases that may involve the protein alpha-synuclein that you'll hear so much about today. So we have a discovery that excites us all. It gives hope to those who have the disease or know of the disease in their family. And we have a discovery that provides inspiration for all of us who do medical research to push ahead toward the conquest of Parkinson's and other diseases we hope to be understood through the study of what remains to be learned about this important event we're describing today. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Dr. Blumenroffel.
It is true that it has not been very long that we were in the same room discussing a very similar theme. I am here to report today that my research team has succeeded for the first time in identifying a gene responsible for Parkinson's disease. We have determined that an alteration in a human gene is responsible for the symptoms of Parkinson's disease in some families with illness. This genetic alteration was found in a previously known gene that codes for the alpha-synuclein protein. I would like to talk to you about the process that led to the discovery, the frequency of the altered gene in the population, and some thoughts of how it may work to produce illness. 7 months ago it was when I reported that we had determined the general location of a gene for Parkinson's disease. That localization was done using patient material from a large Italian family with illness. I told you then in November that the localization to a region of human chromosome 4 was by analogy as if we were looking for a burned out ball in a house somewhere in the US, and we had narrowed down our search in an area not bigger than Washington, D.C. We have today identified both the house and the burnt out bulb. Having narrowed down the region even further, we began a search for a misspelling in the DNA code, a misspelling in an area of about 6 million bases. We were lucky that on top of our list of candidates was a previously known gene, the gene for alpha-synuclein protein, previously known to map in the general region. Using our map, we confirmed the location and started sequencing directly DNA from the affected individuals in the Italian family. The sequencing was looking for a misspelling somewhere in the DNA code that could cause the illness. We detected a single and only letter misspelling out of the 450 letters that code for the entire length for the alpha-synuclein gene. This misspelling results in one amino acid change amino acids are the building blocks of proteins. One amino acid change out of the 140 that make up the protein. Additionally, three Greek families with the illness turned out to carry the exact same misspelling. Upon closer inspection, the three Greek families and the Italian family shared beyond the typical features of Parkinson's disease one more characteristic. The illness started early in life with onset in their 30s, 40s, and 50s. We now come to the next question. In what portion of the Parkinson's patient population this mutation is expected to be found? We did address this question by looking at the DNA of 50-plus individuals with the so-called sporadic form of illness. None of these 50 people carried the mutation. This immediately suggests that the mutation in the synuclein gene will not account for the majority of the genetic factors responsible for Parkinson's disease. However, it is possible that a substantial fraction of those families with early onset Parkinson's disease will carry the mutation. It is possible also that a misspelling elsewhere in the 450 letter code of the synuclein gene is responsible in other Parkinson's disease cases, or that other similar genes elsewhere in the genome may harbor mutations. In any case, finding of a mutation in the alpha-synuclein gene in families with Parkinson's offers tantalizing clues about the mechanism that leads to the death of nerve cells and the production of symptoms of Parkinson's disease. It is very interesting that the human alpha-synuclein was first isolated from brains of patients with Alzheimer's disease, the other common neurodegenerative disorder, which is primarily characterized by dementia. The protein was shown to localize in the ends of nerves, the nerve terminals. And another important clue we have is that in birds, it is implicated in song learning, giving a very, very interesting aspect into the function, the normal function of the protein. In the case of the mutation found in the Parkinson's patients, we hypothesize that the single amino acid substitution leads to an abnormal shape conformation of the protein. This abnormal conformation may lead to clumping of the protein and the attraction of other material. This developing meshwork of protein debris then may become resistant to the normal mechanisms of the cell for breakdown. This process of establishing this meshwork can take from years to decades to develop. Once a large number of nerve cells has been destroyed in critical areas of the brain, like the substantia nigra, it is then that the symptoms of the motor disease, known as Parkinson's disease, begin to develop. The finding does not change the current treatment of patients with Parkinson's disease. However, it is for the first time since the year 1817, when James Parkinson first described the illness, that we can begin research to develop drugs aimed at the cause and not just the symptoms of the illness. Finally, I believe that Parkinson's disease will turn out to be a 100-piece puzzle. The mutation in the alpha-synuclein gene is a central piece of this puzzle and also gives us a clue of what the puzzle may look like once it is finally solved. Thank you.
So you've heard from Dr. Poumeropoulos about how his research team made the discovery of an alteration in one gene that can cause Parkinson's disease. I'm sure that patients with Parkinson's disease have a number of questions about what this finding really means for them and their families, and I'd like to address some of those questions. Does this result mean that all Parkinson's disease is caused by this alteration in the alpha-synuclein gene? Well, as you heard, certainly not. We're sure that this mutation is responsible for some familial Parkinson's disease, perhaps a majority, perhaps a minority. We don't know yet. However, there are likely to be other mutations in this gene or other related genes which may contribute to the disease. Secondly, is all Parkinson's disease, including the forms that don't seem to have a strong family history, are they due to a mutation in this or other genes? We think that's unlikely, but it certainly needs to be investigated before we have any definitive answers. And furthermore, this gene and its product, alpha-synuclein, may play a role in the development of Parkinson's disease, even if it does not carry a mutation. Should all patients with Parkinson's disease be tested for this mutation? We're not going to be able to answer some of the basic questions about the role that this gene and mutations in this gene play without doing further research. It may be possible, for example, to identify individuals at risk in some of the families in which these mutations are found who are at risk but don't show the disease yet, and be able to develop clinical protocols for testing methods for intervening, perhaps delaying or preventing the onset of the disease. But all such testing really must be done in the right way. If you have Parkinson's disease and you decide to be tested for changes in this or other genes, finding that change is not going to change your current treatment, but it will have immediate implications for your relatives, who will now find themselves, perhaps, at a greater risk for having the same change, and therefore at a much greater risk for developing the disease. Finding out that family members are at risk for carrying a gene for Parkinson's disease can have major psychological effects, as well as impact on insurance and employment. Furthermore, if you're a family member, or you have someone with a disease but you don't have it yourself, testing you must be done with even greater caution, as you may discover that you carry a gene alteration but have no signs of the disease yourself. Such testing needs to be done only after extremely careful counseling and discussion of these very thorny issues. What effect does this finding have on treatment? As you heard from Dr. Plumeropoulos, we don't believe that these results have an immediate or direct application to treatment. However, I'd like you to imagine that you're investigating a series of very baffling robberies in which employees arrive in the morning and they find the display cases and the vaults have been cleaned out. No witnesses, no clues. The identification of this mutation in alpha-synuclein is equivalent to announcing that the ringleader of one of those gangs has been arrested. You may not know the identity of the rest of the gang members, and you may not know how they committed the crimes, or even how many gangs are operating. But the first of the culprits is in custody. You'll be happy to hear that that culprit is cooperating with the authorities, and he's telling us everything he knows.
Dr. Hall.
As director of the National Institute of Neurological Disorders and Stroke, which has primary responsibility at NIH for research on Parkinson's disease, I'm absolutely delighted by the findings reported here today. They truly represent the beginning of a new chapter in Parkinson's disease research. Parkinson's disease affects more than 500,000 Americans. All of us know someone with this disease. Parkinson's occurs because a group of nerve cells in our brains become dysfunctional and die for unknown reasons. These cells help us make quick and easy movements, and their loss gives rise to the symptoms of Parkinson's that we're familiar with: tremor, stiffness, a difficulty in initiating movement. In the 1960s, research on Parkinson's disease took a major step forward with the discovery that nerve cells that die are those that make and secrete a chemical called dopamine. This discovery, which led to the development of what is now the standard treatment for Parkinson's disease, the administration of L-DOPA, has been the major idea driving Parkinson's research for the last 30 years. Virtually all of the treatments for Parkinson's disease that are now being used or are being tried are attempts to replace or compensate for the loss of these cells.
What has been missing is any understanding of why the cells become damaged and die. Today's findings are important because they give us a new idea, an idea that could lead to understanding of how these cells are injured and new treatments to slow them in their inexorable degeneration. Before these findings, no one knew that alpha-synuclein was involved in Parkinson's disease. The function of the protein, as you have heard, is unknown, but it has several provocative and tantalizing features that may lead us to the pathway of cell death for these neurons. The possible link between Parkinson's disease and Alzheimer's disease suggested by this protein is especially important because it suggests that the mechanisms of neurodegeneration and these two diseases may be related. This discovery will stimulate a whole new avenue of research on Parkinson's disease. Our hope is that it will be as important as the discovery of the loss of dopamine in the 1960s. Let me say a word finally about how the finding came about, because I think it illustrates a point about science and about the NIH. In 1995, our institute and three others sponsored a meeting on Parkinson's disease whose purpose was to stimulate new directions in research. One of the conclusions of this meeting, in which Dr. Nussbaum participated, was that the genetics of Parkinson's deserve further exploration. Out of that meeting came a collaboration between a group of Italian and American neurologists led by Roger Duvoisin and Robert Wood Johnson Medical School, who had been studying Parkinson's families for decades, and a group of NIH scientists led by Drs. Nussbaum and Polymeropoulos, who had been working on the human genome and who had the molecular tools and experience required to meet this challenge. The success of this work illustrates the importance of collaboration between the NIH institutes, an international group of neurologists, those that I mentioned, now joined by Greek colleagues, by patient organizations, and by the patients themselves. It also illustrates the ability of the NIH to act quickly and decisively when new scientific opportunities are presented. Let me end by saying that these findings represent a moment of triumph for all of us who are involved in Parkinson's disease, but it is only a beginning. Much hard work remains to explore this finding so that it may be translated into effective therapy for the many.
Well, as you've heard, until today, we could say quite a bit about the what of Parkinson's disease, but we couldn't say very much about the why. That was a black box that had pretty much remained unpenetrated by numerous and valiant attempts to pry it open. Now, at least for a fraction of patients, a window has been opened into that black box, and we have at least one answer to why in those circumstances. As you see it on this poster up here, a single letter out of the 3 billion base pair genome gone awry, capable of producing this illness in these families that you've heard described. Of course, this answer raises many more questions. That's the nature of the scientific inquiry process and the nature of research. But I don't think it's an overstatement to say that when the book is written some undetermined years from now that describes how Parkinson's disease was ultimately understood and even cured, I believe that this discovery will occupy an important chapter in that book. Is this too grand a prediction? After all, you've heard that probably only a small fraction of individuals with Parkinson's disease have this precise cause. But we are counting on this particular window into the black box to illuminate its other dark corners, to reveal its secrets. And we expect we'll find other triggers for this illness besides the genetic one, which has been laid out in this particular report. I can't help but point out that this rapid pace of gene discovery, exemplified by today's result for Parkinson's disease, is happening all around us. As director of the Human Genome Project, this is a gratifying outcome. The tools of genetic maps and physical maps and placing genes on the map before anybody is quite sure why they'll want to know they're there is paying off in the almost weekly discoveries of genes for human illnesses, and I think that is something to feel very good about. What used to take a decade, that is to go from a general idea of the neighborhood to the gene itself, in this instance took 7 months, and that's a credit to the researchers who did the work, to be sure. I also can't help but point out a concern. In addition to celebrating this remarkable advance, patients with Parkinson's disease and their families may also now have a potential reason to worry about their future in a new way. In this regard, they may now join the ranks of families with breast cancer, ovarian cancer, Alzheimer's disease, Huntington's disease, and many others, ranks that will eventually swell to include all of us because we are all walking around with alterations in our DNA sequence that place us at risk for something. So this discovery is one more reason to redouble our efforts to make sure that genetic information can be used by individuals to their benefit and not used against them to deny them health insurance or a job, and not used in a way that invades their privacy. With the passage of the Kassebaum-Kennedy bill last fall, and it becomes, I'm happy to say, active in exactly 5 days, there are more protections at the federal level for health insurance discrimination against genetics than there have ever been. But there are still loopholes. And I would point you towards Secretary Shalala's statement, which underlines the importance of plugging those loopholes. There is bipartisan support in the U.S. Congress to do this, in the current Congress. The President himself, 1 month ago in a commencement address, made it a personal priority to make sure that no individual, be it someone from a family with Parkinson's disease or some other illness, need worry about seeking access to genetic information because of fears that it will be used to deny them something as basic as health care. Today, I think we have unwrapped a present for families with Parkinson's disease, a present whose future is still a little unclear. It would be wonderful if this year we could give all of ourselves a present, and that is to take care of this unfortunate circumstance of genetic discrimination once and for all. That concludes the planned presentations, and I would like to now open the floor to questions. I will ask those who are posing questions, if you could, to identify which speaker you would like to answer the question. If you're not sure, I'll try to do the triage. And I will repeat the question because I understand that sometimes it's helpful if it sort of turns up on the microphones that are up here. And I'll ask those who are answering the questions to step up to the podium so that their answers can be heard as well. Yes, sir. So the question is, how could this gene discovery lead to a treatment? One of you two should take this on. Dr. Nussbaum.
The hypothesis that we're operating under now is that this change in the protein results in the protein taking on an abnormal shape, and that that shape causes the protein perhaps to aggregate, to self-aggregate, and perhaps to pull other proteins in. And that this meshwork, as Dr. Plumeropoulos described, can grow very slowly, become resistant to the normal processes by which such proteins are broken down. I would say that one of the first targets, and one that I'm quite sure a number of pharmaceutical companies would be quite interested in looking at, would be to develop molecules that interfere with that aggregation process and prevent it from occurring. So you might be able to block the process before it gets any worse, or perhaps prevent it from even beginning, and therefore allow the cell to degrade the proteins or break them down in the normal way. So that's one way that we could try to intervene in this process and treat this disorder, if indeed this is the correct hypothesis. It's being tried now, not in clinical trials, but in laboratories looking at Alzheimer's disease, because there's a similar situation in which there's a change in a particular protein which results in aggregation, and there are some attempts to do that. There's also some disorders called amyloidosis and a number of others in which there's a similar kind of aggregation of proteins in which there are drugs that are being developed to block that kind of aggregation process.
I just wanted to follow that up on the question, if there are any examples. In fact, there is another example of proteins that create a meshwork with each other. When they get a shape that is zigzag, I'll represent it with my fingers, so the proteins block like that. And that's prion disease, which is very well known as the Madgau-Jakob-Creutzfeldt disease. And in fact, there was a publication in Science only a couple of months ago where trials to break that aggregation and inhibit it were successful in animals, in hamsters, and they slowed down the process. So that field is open and quite doable.
Thank you. By the way, I think the press has in their packets examples of these two diagrams. This one marks hypothesis, and let's be sure that's understood, that this clumping of proteins is a hypothesis, is demonstrated on the poster here to my left, and hopefully helps you visualize a little bit what this model is that's being presented. Are there other questions? Follow up? Polymeropolis. It just flows off the tongue. Question is, what about this link to Alzheimer's?
I would not state it that robustly that there is a link. The only clue that we have is that in the brains of patients with Alzheimer's disease, you find a structure called plaques, which we know it is a meshwork of protein debris and several material there. One very important participant in that meshwork is beta amyloid, a key fraction of peptide that is found in the plaques. When people looked and asked the question, what else is there? The second most abundant component of those plaques turned out to be a fragment of the alpha-synuclein protein. It has not been established that it has a causative role, but we at least know that it is a participant of that meshwork.
Actually, I think it was Dr. Kowal who made the comment. Dr. Varnas in cell biology, right? He was the one who brought it up, I think. Well, I don't want to be too specific about this, but as you have heard, this is an abundant protein in nerve cells. It's associated with what are called synaptic vesicles that are important in delivering neurotransmitters. There's some interesting features of the way this protein is folded up, and the mutation itself is in a position that raises new questions for people who study how proteins fold. So I think the combination of this protein being involved in these aggregating phenomena, aggregation itself is an interesting object of study for many diseases, not just Alzheimer's and Parkinson's, from the point of view of understanding how proteins fold individually and from the point of view of understanding how nerve cells deliver their chemicals to other nerve cells. There are a lot of new directions here, and I think that's the important thing to emphasize, that investigators who are working in a variety of fields, structural biology, genetics, clinical neurology, and neuroscience more generally, will be captivated by this. The finding will change their direction in ways that will yield results I fortunately cannot predict. If I could predict them, they'd be very boring.
Many things. It would take about 3 hours to describe them. But let me say the clear direction, at least for the next few days or months. We would like to trace down more genetic components. As we discussed before, we have already evidence that similar genes to the alpha-synuclein gene are hiding elsewhere in the genome. We want to go and look and ask the question whether there are misspellings in those genes in other patients with Parkinson's. Second is to understand how this abnormal protein now, the alpha-synuclein, may actually cause the illness, to ask very interesting questions whether it is found in the structures found in the patients with Parkinson's, the Lewy bodies. And a third immediate is to develop an animal model for Parkinson's, and that will be a mouse where a normal human gene along with his partner, the Parkinson's disease gene, have been replacing the mouse gene. All these would be immediate attempts to develop tools to understand more. And I don't want to discuss about treatments again, because that is something that will come long, long later. I'm sure for that.
The question is, would an insurer or an employer be able to take a DNA sample from blood or some other source and determine if that person is likely to get Parkinson's disease? Once again, let's be sure that we're clear that this particular misspelling, this A instead of a G in this alpha-synuclein gene, probably accounts for a rather small fraction of Parkinson's disease. It's a very critical question to determine what fraction that is, but it will probably be quite small. So most of the time, someone who is destined to develop Parkinson's disease would, if you looked at this DNA sequence, have the normal spelling. The cause in most people with this disease apparently is of some other sort, but the excitement about this discovery is the hope, and it's a hope that's based on long experience in other circumstances, that a similar pathway will be involved, but triggered by a different influence than the genetic one. But I would hasten to say that in the subset who do turn out to have a strong hereditary influence, as for instance these four families that are described in this paper, yes, it would be possible for someone to determine in a relatively young person whether they've inherited this alteration and are therefore at very high risk, about 85% in these families, of developing the disease. And for that kind of test to be done without that person's full consent is, I think, completely unacceptable. And I think all those who have looked at this issue from the point of view of what's ethical would agree with that. Even if the person chose to have the test done for their own benefit, as for instance, people will perhaps now be doing as part of research projects to try to get better answers to this, I think most of us feel very strongly that that information should be off limits to a health insurer and to an employer and to other third parties, unless the person whose DNA sample it is gives a full consent to that kind of distribution of the information. We do not at the present time have sufficient protections in place to assure people that mischief can't occur, and this discovery here again today underlines the need to take care of those things.
Could you repeat the question?
I guess the question is, what is the frequency of the familial form of Parkinson's disease? That's a difficult question to answer. There is dispute in the literature, but I think we can conservatively estimate that 10 to 20% of patients with Parkinson's have other relatives with illness.
Well, if there are no more questions, I would like to thank all of you for coming today. I think the principals up here at the table might be willing to hang around for a few minutes if you wanted an individual opportunity to ask follow-up questions. Thank you all, and we're adjourned.